My name is Senthil Rajaram. I'm a PM in the Hyper-V team, program manager. I basically do very little as a program manager. The real work is done by the devs and tests. So we have here Bial. He's a new upcoming star in our Hyper-V test team who's pegged the entire SMB team on bugs currently. They're all sweating from his one system. Anyway, there's still a lot of work to be done in this particular scenario. That's what we're finding out. What I'm trying to do with this particular presentation is give you a heads up on the kind of problems that we tried to solve for the Hyper-V workload with the SMB3 protocol. We'll also switch over to a freeform Q&A, and then I want Bial to present a PowerShell script that the reason why I was asking whether you guys are ready for stress testing is we expected some of you at least to be here. So we've put together a framework of PowerShell scripts that's going to instantiate a lot of VMs and get you in a state that will allow you to generate a lot of IO workload. So he's going to walk you through the PowerShell scripts. I just want to make another quick introduction. So Sujit is a test lead specifically focused from the Hyper-V over SMB scenario. And Bial actually reports into him. So they've been doing all the good work with making sure that the scenario is rock solid. So I'll just give them that. So with respect to, just give you guys a little bit of background. Hyper-V over SMB as a project started not with SMB 3.0. We tried to do it with 2.1, right? There was this project, and we did this all this prototype, and we got it ready, and we got it tested, but there was enough holes in the scenario. When you're talking about a virtualization workload, you're talking about aggregating workloads into one particular failure path too, right? And things are not rock solid. The impacts are that much wider. So with our previous versions, there were enough holes in migration scenarios and resiliency support scenarios that we're taking down these workloads pretty easily. We kind of killed that project. We went to the SMB team. SMB team came to us. We kind of fed our requirements into the new protocol version, saying, these are the needs. We want to be sure that the resiliency as well as the performance for the remote storage for Hyper-V is as good as the local one. That's what we aim for. I think we're pretty close to it with respect to all the goals that we wanted to hit. So the primary goal of this was everything needs to work seamlessly. This is just yet another storage option. The only thing that changes is a UNC path instead of a local path. Right? All existing scenarios need to work. Second level paging, migration, you name it. It's all supported. As I mentioned before, just so that we have a rock solid solution, we wanted to require for support SMB 3.0. Even though we haven't actively made a block for a lower protocol version, you will see all those issues that we talked about with respect to resiliency as well as migration being hit. So if a customer calls up and says, I'm running 2.1 Hyper-V in my production, he's not going to get support. But a dev test environment, it's completely fine. We understand that. Not only does SMB allow a deployment configuration, which has been much asked for, since V1, the question has been there, why doesn't Hyper-V support remote storage? It almost seemed like we are taking a stand in the religious war between file and block. We finally got it done, so we are here. The cool part about the SMB support is that it not only allows the existing scenarios to work, but it kind of lit up a few new scenarios. Right? When you talk about shared nothing live migration, the way we do it today is that we create an SMB share on the destination host and move it. Previously, this was not even a supported scenario, right? Because we couldn't create an SMB share for our own files to move. So now, since we know that this is resilient and performant, we kind of use it to do the shared nothing. So there's no shared storage, but we can move a VM over from one host to another. Cross-cluster live migration, pretty much the same. It just detaches from one cluster, creates an SMB share on the other, or if there is a shared SMB node, it uses that. So let's get into the specific problems that we felt that needed to be addressed from a protocol as a workload level. The first thing that, you know, especially with network-based topologies, there are various failure modes that it can run into, both network as well as machine. And I'll walk through how each of these failure paths are addressed through a specific feature set. The first one is the most common one. If you're as clumsy as me, you're walking around the, you know, data center, you see a network, like you trip over a network cable, but you're smart enough to realize that you've done something wrong and you plug it in and everything should be working fine. A part of this kind of sort of worked with 2.1. They had durable handle support, which kind of built upon the TCP timeouts a little bit more. Like I said, durable handles allowed you to persist state information on both sides, waiting for the reconnect to happen for about 30 seconds. With resiliency handles, not only is the timeout longer, I think it's 1 minute. Thomas can correct me if I'm wrong, but for 1 minute, both the client and the server hold state associated with that particular open. The application receives no IRS till that point. If a connection is made, all is well and good. Data flows, whatever is backed up, and everything is hunky-dory. So if you see as a normal operation, you know, simple, if there's a connection goes down, state's maintained, application receives no error. As soon as you plug it back in, everything is hunky-dory. Tom, I think the resiliency timeout is 1 minute, if I'm not mistaken, 60 seconds?
It's on the order of 30 to 60 seconds. I'm not exactly sure.
One other thing that I wanted to point out is the fact that Hyper-V actually, if your target says that it supports 2.2, it uses resiliency handles, specific FSCTR. If you fail it, we are not going to allow you to instantiate VMs on it. We don't use that for 2.1, but if you're saying that you support 2.2, we kind of demand that. One of the questions that came up from a partner was the fact that we require CA, continuous availability, as a configuration for support for Hyper-V workloads. That's not true. The only thing that we require is 2.2 support, either as a standalone or for, what do you say, for CA. We leave it up to the customer to determine whether he wants to that amount of continuous availability for his workload. Any questions here?
Can you repeat what you, it sounded like you said that you're requiring resilient file handles?
Yes.
Always?
Yes, for 2.2.
For Hyper-V.
For Hyper-V.
For Hyper-V 2.2, which ships with?
Hyper-V 2.2, no, Hyper-V. The current Windows Server 2012 version of Hyper-V, when it tries to use a remote file store path, it's going to request for resiliency. And if the resiliency handles fail, then we will.
Okay, so it's not going to rely on persistence.
If it detects a CA share, then it gets persistence with durability automatically. If it's not a CA share, it will attempt the manual persistence FSCTL. If that fails, it'll refuse to use the share.
You mean the, so it needs, you mean the resilience?
Resilience. I'm sorry, resiliency. There's too many words in my head.
Yeah.
If it gets CA, it's happy. If it doesn't get CA, it wants resiliency. If it doesn't get either of those, it won't use the share.
Okay. So it will request persistence on open if it's a continuously available share, right?
Actually, it'll just do a regular open, and the client will request that persistence, yes. That's the behavior of the Windows client.
Clients request persistent handles using durability create context, right?
Right. The durable V2 create context has a flags word that says persistent. The client will automatically, to a CA server, this is in the dot,
right,
send a durable V2 with persistence.
Okay, so that wasn't a Hyper-V decision. That was always done by the redirector.
It's done by the SMB 3.0 redirector when it detects a CA server, when the cap CA is set in the server properties.
Right. So then it requests resilience if it doesn't see that cap.
If it doesn't get that, it will manually do resilience.
Or if you failed the durability create context on the persistent.
Windows servers won't do that, but I guess it would be interesting to test how that works.
Yeah. Yeah.
How does the client detect that it didn't get the persistent handle?
The durability create context?
How does the application detect that it didn't get a persistent handle?
I thought we sent down a specific FSCTL, but I could go back and check that. And if that FSCTL fails,
we would check it locally.
Probably. I don't know what that FSCTL flows across. So. But, you know, we could check right after.
I'm just curious.
Okay.
It's kind of an application question. That's on the border of SMB behavior and application behavior.
Gotcha.
That's why it's tricky. We'll check.
Okay.
The next set of failures that we wanted to tackle is the permanent network failure path, right? We couldn't do it alone in software. You know, we know the Hyper-V team is good, but not that good. We needed hardware support to address this. But it's not uncommon for servers today to have dual NICs, you know, and dual paths to the file share is not something that is of an onerous ask from our team to address this particular scenario. So if you have dual paths, SMB multi-channel kicks in. You guys know about multi-channel. Active paths, it's going to make sure that your throughput through both these paths are maintained. And in case of a failure, just ships it over to the other path, and application receives no I/O error. Everything is hunky-dory. Any questions?
Better provision it well.
Sorry?
Better provision it well, such that you don't have
fair enough. Fair enough. That is a key point that you bring up with virtualization. I think everybody just says the one thing, right? Let me just pick up all these workloads running on disparate machines and throw them into the system. It's virtualized, everything is going to be fine, right? As with any other resource, CPU, memory, network, storage, all depends on how heavily they're getting used. So make sure you provision it well. The other class of failures is machine failures, right? We want it to be persistent to if some customer decides that he needs to like have a really highly available system, then we start talking about, you know, handling machine failures. So with the singleton file server, obviously there's no way out of it, right? If the system goes down, the VMs go down, you know, everything needs to be manually bought back up. Obviously, there are certain customers and scenarios where this is still usable. You can think of a dev test scenario where somebody's doing this, right? So, but in the case that you have a two-node file server in a cluster, there's yet another feature called continuous availability. Actually, it's the foundational feature for 2.2, which kind of allows on a failure on one node, the file share is automatically moved to another node, right? And the handles that are being used are seamlessly, you know, shifted over to the other node's file. The file share being exposed by the other node. Application sees no errors. And this is being tested at scale. And the way this is done is that any write, or I would say any metadata updates that are being sent to the share are actually persisted to the backend disk. And on a failure, all state necessary to replay those handles and instantiate that to the application are present. So the other node comes up, picks up the states, you know, goes through its checklist, instantiates the shares, reconnects the handles, everything is fine. Hyper-V didn't have to do anything here to actually make use of this feature. All this has been done transparently for us. And what about Hyper-V node failures, right? Well, there shouldn't be any gotchas here, technically, right? But think about the case where, you know, one of the Hyper-V nodes, everything is operating normal, one of the Hyper-V node goes down. The VMs are now shifted over to the other node because of the clustering mechanism. Now, the VMs from the other node try to open handles to the files that were being opened by the VMs on from the earlier node, right? Now, this is where persistence kicks in, or resiliency kicks in. Remember, it's holding state from the earlier open for 60 seconds. So if we hadn't done anything, now you would see this particular VM stall for 60 seconds before it could get access to that particular file. So we have this feature called cluster client failover. And what this does is allows Hyper-V or a VM to communicate that it's an instance of an application requesting access to a particular file. And even if the instance moves to a different node, it can communicate that particular instance ID to allow the file server to make the right decisions. So in this case, the file server knows, hey, you know, for some reason, I don't know what, the guy has moved to a different node, VM has moved to a different node, he's requesting access to the file, so he shoots down the stale handles and gets the, you know, allows the new open to succeed. Otherwise, we would have noticed a 60 seconds delay. So this feature is called cluster client. Any questions here?
Got a presentation on that this morning, Klaus.
Klaus is always stealing my thunder.
From a Hyper-V management workflow perspective, another important scenario that we needed to think about is, you know, host-based backup. Having an agent and the guest is just not an acceptable solution. It just increases the management complexity and cost associated with VMs. So what's done here is the file server team implemented remote VSS. So from a backup vendor perspective, there's absolutely no change except for the fact that when you request a snapshot of the volume that is hosting the VHD files, instead of the local volume being invoked, the remote VSS agent kicks in, sends it to the remote VSS provider on the file share. The same workflow happens. There's a snapshot of that volume, remote volume, and it's presented as a snap to the backup agent. So this is the remote VSS feature. Again, just for nothing to be done from a Hyper-V perspective, but for the overall scenario to work, this was important.
So only thing you require probably app instance registration. That's for the previous one. You have to register for the application instance.
You're talking about cluster client failover?
Yes.
So what we do, Hyper-V, as in, whenever it opens a VM, it uses the VM GUID as the app instance ID when it tries to do a create file via. I think the mechanism by which it's passed is an ECP, extra create parameter, and that's available only from the kernel mode. We use that. With respect to performance, SMB Direct is something that is exciting. It's incredibly important for any virtualization scenarios to consider any available method to reduce the host involvement in, you know, whether processing I/O, network, like storage I/O, network I/O, CPU load on it, and that's important because that's the constraining factor for increasing consolidation. SMB Direct allows us that. It takes away the CPU's involvement with respect to network processing. Was there a presentation on that too? This will be direct? Nope? Okay. So for certain scenarios, the Hyper-V team is actually going to be going out and saying, use RDMA if you're really keen on performance for this particular scenario. So you will see that guidance being sent out. Another important feature that we tout is SMB multi-channel for performance, not only for resiliency, but also for performance. I don't have any numbers. I was hoping that the SMB team would probably already convinced you on how highly performant this overall solution is?
It's been discussed many times, so we haven't done a specific presentation.
Yeah.
The general skepticism I see from virtualization people who are familiar with VMware or all the Hypervisor or KVM.
Yeah.
The general skepticism I hear is that it could never perform as well. It's a difficult apples to oranges comparison when you're comparing VMware or KVM to Hyper-V anyway,
yeah.
Especially when you have Hyper-V, Hyper-V to Hyper-V would be different as well because you've obviously changed and improved the engine. But I wonder if you have any feel for your Hyper-V current version, what this is like on a block device traditionally configured versus running over SMB3, what it would be like running on a local disk versus...
We actually did that comparison recently. And obviously, you have to have the right set of hardware. But what happened is we put a SAN, directly connected it to Hyper-V host, measured throughput for a particular scenario, took that same SAN to a file server to be the backing of the file server, served the file share, and used, I think we used 10 gig network connections into the file share.
Mm-hmm.
And the performance was literally, I think in some scenarios, SMB was performing better.
And that is also assuming that RDMA is used?
Yeah, RDMA or 10 gig, yeah.
All that put in, it comes really close.
So what I was saying is, if you have RDMA included as well, on the connection from the Hyper-V nodes to the server, the performance is pretty much on par when it comes to local.
So I guess the other way to put this is if you're using local disks versus shared disk, forget RDMA for a minute.
Got it.
Jim or one of the other people did a chart that showed that, the database benchmark was within 5% of the best they could achieve locally. And I'm wondering if we're sort of in that ballpark here, within 5%.
A lot of it depends on the configurations of the system, right?
I
hate to say a statement saying, yes, we are within 5%, which will be blown out of proportion. If you're staging a VHD with a suboptimal block size, which doesn't match well with the I/O size over the wire, you're starting talking about various things. Is it sequential? Is it random writes?
Yeah,
CA configuration already has penalties with respect to random writes because they need to persist stuff onto the...
I guess the bigger question is, when we talk to customers, let's say that you're a Windows... you're a Windows admin, and you're talking to various storage people about how you're going to lay out storage. At some point, they're going to look for numbers and trade-offs involved in doing in how you configure Hyper-V. And the data is scattered that I've seen, but it looks great.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there are anything a little more objective about the trade-offs of running over SMB mounts versus not. And, what I've seen looks like it's just as fast, so why not? But I'm wondering if those are collected anywhere.
We will be putting out something called the file server, it's called the server performance tuning guide. We'll try to get a lot of these, gotchas there, saying, if you're experiencing performance issues, look at one of these factors. I don't know whether you're asking...
Here's another way to put it. Are there any cases when you'd never do this?
Is there any case where you'd never mount over SMB3? You mentioned certain block size, but can you think of any particular Hyper-V virtualization scenarios? You're virtualizing a Windows 98 client or something, right? Pick something.
No, there's nothing to do with the guest that we can think is going to impact it. It's all host-based IOs, right?
Okay.
So
at this point, all configurations are either as good or preferred over SMB mounts?
I wouldn't say. It's just yet another option for storage configuration. I wouldn't say I'm going to take sides on block versus file. It's just whatever the customer. A lot of the IT organizations, you know, they prefer file over block for whatever reason, because they got skill sets that they've built up over the years. So,
but right now there's no qualification that you might say where this workload do block.
No.
Okay.
We wanted to actively make that statement, saying these storage options are equal.
I guess we have to limit what is the maximum latency you should be.
Yes.
So latency should be a factor.
Yeah. Provisioning, right? As long as you provision with the right hardware, with the right set of parameters, I think you should be fine on either case.
Yeah.
So the issue about latency is specifically somewhere where you need a hardware assist. And that was the discussion this morning about some of the InfiniBand stuff, for example. But specifically RDMA, and I think Tom is a good person to talk to about that. We believe that the relative latency, especially with when RDMA is used, is actually in our favor. But as far as the provisioning and stuff, we believe it's also much easier. I mean, I've been a fiber channel. No, I'm biased the other way. I've been a fiber channel guy since '99, and have dealt with them both from a customer side of the enterprise and from dealing on the vendor side of the stuff. And it's you know what you pay those guys. They're not cheap.
But if I conclude that all this SMB 3.4 feature is primarily important within the data center, the two level within the data center. The server and the file server.
So I think the question is, I'll let you ask the
question.
Yeah, basically all these features, when you have separate your app server with the file server and extend your provisioning disk, use file server, but there's still restriction that they should be close by.
Yeah,
most of the features.
Yeah.
But how do you sell that? Because the moment you say that you can have a file server and some customer thinking of having a cloud storage and the application is still in the data center, it's not going to work, correct? It's not going to have the similar performance or may not work at all.
Right. I mean, that we're not trying to compare cloud to data center that's on a LAN. Storage that's on a LAN in a data center. Just as we would across a dark fiber WAN. Right? I mean, latency is important. It's important to be able to do that.
Yeah, but I think the comparison between RDMA and SAN is a close to apples, I think. And like the earlier talk where the SQL Server guy showed how RDMA is actually 10 times cheaper than SAN, it makes perfect sense to be making that statement. I think I saw another statement somewhere where on some benchmark, the SMB was like within 95% of the local.
There are cases where it's actually beat the local too.
Yeah, it's actually better in terms of overhead and equivalent in terms of speed because it's maxed out the local storage.
But for me, I don't want to go out and make that statement saying, you know, these are options available, right? If you have the right configurations, hardware as well as software, you're going to get pretty much similar performance.
What might help is, you guys have done a good job this time around putting all storage options together.
Yeah.
You might want to say, okay, this option works well in this scenario. This option, it's almost like a table. Then
I want to go out and say all options are equivalent if you have the right
thing.
You
can't make that statement because that's the wrong statement.
Interesting.
But we can
I want to pick your brains on that.
We can make a statement that the playing ground is level enough that as a customer, you should be able to make the decision.
Yeah,
not
I think we're leaving it up to customers.
Yeah.
But they might be like, all right, so let's say Spaces has a known issue with particular configuration, then you're asking us to call it out saying, limit this particular.
Yeah, okay, so agreed. What I'm saying is that it might help if Microsoft if Microsoft helped customers to evaluate
Got it.
or the criterion based on which to evaluate what their use case will benefit from.
Okay.
See, that will help. I mean, you don't have to make a statement, but you at least know what matters. Right?
Fair enough. I think that's very good feedback. I think there's already, like, I know I spoke with Jose on kind of helping provision. He had built up a fancy Excel spreadsheet on, you know, the various configurations.
Yeah, I mean, we'll try to get columns which explain, if you do this, yeah, this is what it affects.
The person he's referring to, Jose Barreto, is a PM in the SMB team, and he does have a number of sort of practical deployment possibilities using 10 gig E, using InfiniBand, using...
I don't think that's being publicized, but the feedback that Shashir is giving is that, you know, you better publicize.
Yeah.
That's fair. Just going on with the presentation before we go into a free-form Q&A, I do want to give enough time for Biav to walk through the partial script. From a management perspective, there's a couple of gotchas, right? So before the gotchas, I want to say that SMB PowerShell and Hyper-V PowerShell is going to get you through a lot of these scenarios. And it's plumbed end-to-end. It's going to be really easy to script if you're running from a Windows box. So the one key thing that most people run into when they try to instantiate VMs on an SMB PowerShell is that the permissions are not set up correctly. Everybody's shaking their head, you know? So the reason for this is the fact that, you know, each VM has their own security identifier. And as soon as you start sending the security identifiers across the machine boundaries, it doesn't make any sense. So the security module converts them to the Hyper-V host machine account's security identifiers. And that's the reason why you need those particular shares, as well as the NTFS shares backing that file share, to have full control for Hyper-V machine accounts. And any administrators who are performing any operations on those particular VHDs and file shares needs to have that access. Does that kind of make sense? Why we put out these particular... Almost had a question. You want to, anything that I can clarify?
No, I was just wondering if the admin tools, if they do checks for...
The Hyper-V, the cluster, what is it called? The cluster check wizard.
Cluster validation.
The cluster validation wizard actually does this check, but the Hyper-V UI doesn't. The PowerShell doesn't have a way to do that still. If you hit an access denied error, this is... The one thing that we actually haven't solved is the remote management double hop issue. So you have to manually configure constraint delegation for you to be managing these systems from a remote, the classic double hop issue. Yeah. Yes.
At some levels, Active Directory with the concept of trees and forests should make it easier to map the...
The traditional Active Directory
hierarchy
should make it easier in a way. The machine that you're managing is running as a machine within a particular domain. It has a machine identity already.
Yeah. You're talking about the permissions or the constraint delegation? You're talking about permissions.
Yes,
the way that we actually go out and say is, have an Active Directory set up and use a group, which automatically... So you set up a group, you add the Hyper-V machine account to that particular group, provision the shares to have that particular group as full access, then you've solved the problem.
Yeah, I mean, in effect, that machine already was in the Active Directory domain.
Yeah.
So it's not new.
Yep. We are trying to make the story better going ahead, but you would need to create a specific group, add those groups to the thing, and that's what I was trying to say, right? It's not done automatically for you. I know where you're going. It's not there today.
Yeah.
I don't have anything more from a presentation point of view, so. I'll open it up to, have you guys taken a look at the PowerShell scripts that we had put out from our earlier plug test? Do they have access to that with respect to the...
Not yet, but I
will. Oh, really? Okay.
Some of them did, but not everyone here was participating in by any stretch.
So if you had come for the last plug fest, we had given a bunch of PowerShell scripts that help you validate functionality end-to-end.
Ah, but they did receive Jose Barreto's blog.
Blog post,
which
so.
Described the scenarios from sort of from end-to-end, a step-by-step. I'll make sure to include that again. We had it in our preparation items for the event. I'll put it in the and also, I know you have some scripts that you wanted us to disseminate. So we'll do that as a follow-up item from the event.
So what I want you to get out of this particular like Q&A as well as the scripts is the fact that you can take these particular scripts and make it really usable in your own testing with all the scenarios covered and ensure that you do these testing from your environment when you go back. You're not limited to doing Hyper-V over SMB testing when you're here. It's great when you're here, you want to make use of us to, you know, figure out any blocking issues that you can't. So we'll try to be at the next Pluckfest in STC, but we'll see. What I want to encourage, to focus the message on is you have all the tools and the contacts necessary to make progress while you're not here, back in your own office. Yeah, we just want to talk about. So this particular script that we have put together, again, PowerShell-based, very simply, allows you to easily instantiate a bunch of VMs on a particular host that you could use IO stress within to just, you know, instantiate load on the SMB file share. And I know you guys, what we were actually expecting, a lot, like at least most of you would be ready for stress testing. So that's probably not the case, so we'll probably have to wait for another time, but we'll show you the script anyway so that if you guys are ready before the next event, you guys will be able to use it.
My name is Bill. I'm working in the Hyper-V team. I'm doing some testing for Hyper-V on SMB. Actually, the script is very simple. If you know the Hyper-V PowerShell command, it's just maybe 50 or 20 lines of code. You can do, you can create a VM, you can do VM operation, and you can start something like the start or stop of VM or doing some migration of the VM to test whether your Hyper-V on SMB scenario is working in your environment. And what I have here is the script has some like a parameter VM account and pass to the base OS BHD. So normally when I test my Hyper-V on SMB setting, I will have a base OS BHD like the
base PhD there. Can you hear me?
No.
Sorry.
The laptop. Put the laptop.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Put it on the laptop and get it done in front of that.
Keep going. Is the button on?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. So I have a parameter based passed to the base OS BHD. What I'm doing here is,
normally I have a.
You guys just point it up.
Point it up.
I'm just holding it, if you don't mind.
Please sound like you're going to drive my eardrums into the center of my head.
It's fine, I just held it in. That's
fine. It's a pop.
Yeah, you.
Okay. Normally I have one base VHD, which is the actual operating system. Like when I'm doing the test, I will pick up a server 2008 R2, a base VHD. Which a base VHD means you can boot up using this VHD and then in the VHD, once the VM is boot up, it's actual operating system inside, and you can start a testing right away. So I prepared this kind of base VHD with L-meter inside already, and then I put VHD normally in a SMB pass, and then after I start creating the VMs, I will use this base VHD and create a lot of difference in VHD, and the difference in VHD will be attached to this base VHD and create a VM. And the VM directory means where I'm going to put my VM. Normally it's SMB shell, of course, in this case. VM workload VHD size is the size of it, because when you are running L-meter, you will need an additional raw disk attached to the guest. Then you can start L-meter against that raw VHD. A dummy VHD is a dummy VHD here. So I can briefly go through the steps. Where do I have? Yeah. So the new VM, this is the command we can create a VM here. We can provide a VM name. And originally, I didn't provide a VHD here because I'm going to create a difference VHD first using the base VHD and attach that difference in VHD to this VM. This is creating the difference in VHD. Actually, all commands, I mean, altogether we have around, I'm only using 4 or 3 commands here, which can accomplish our task here to create a VM with an operating system inside, and to start a VM and configure a VM memory. And once the VM is started, you can start L-meter inside the guest. That's it, I think. That's actually pretty simple.
We'll share the script with you guys so that you guys can take it.
Use this. By the way, this script can be run anywhere, I mean, as long as you have PowerShell. That's enough.
And we'll make sure that you have access to that script, as I said, after your follow-up items in a mail and in a shared directory for you, and any blog locations, as I mentioned, from Jose and from the virtualization team. So we'll certainly give you those links.
And use this in conjunction with the previous PowerShell scripts. Make sure that you're testing both the scenarios of like the intermittent network failure, the permanent network failure, the Hyper-V machines going down when the IOMeter is blasting away, the file server is going down when the IOMeter is blasting away. Like all those 4 failure paths are really important to have, you know, figured out and rock solid before we ship.
You have a question?
Use us.
Any questions?
Just curious about how many people in here use PowerShell at all for anything, not the Microsoft people. Okay, so a few, all right.
So we'll be here for like, is it today, the last year, tomorrow?
Today we're wrapping up. I just wanted to say these folks from the Hyper-V team have been extremely diligent in preparing some test scenarios. A few of you have had a chance to work with them or see their demos. They have a way of generating a lot of SMB traffic. So we're primarily not interested necessarily in the application, but in what those requirements are at the protocol layer. So you as the developer of the protocol implementations are interested in those requirements. And I think it interwoven in this, you hear, again, continuous availability and all of those requirements that are implemented in the protocol. And the traffic generates some interesting problems. And many interoperability scenarios have been generated successfully as a result of this testing. So thanks to the team for all that work. They are still here if you have questions. Also, I'd like to make a suggestion that for this event, we offered the 10 gigabit environment, which, as you know, we had to sort of pull through the hallways to those of you who had that. In the future, if when let's say in next event in March, we do this again, we would certainly offer the 10 gigabit environment again. And if you have support for that as a client or a server load workload, we would certainly appreciate the opportunity to join the testing into that dedicated network environment. We're not focused on performance testing at all for the purpose of interoperability, but if we can facilitate the generation of this scenario, we want to step up the game and help you in that way. So I know some of you have said this is a requirement, as Centel has mentioned, and I know many of you in the storage industry have said so. So we'll do the best we can with that. And SW, did you want to mention anything about
Yeah, just at Storage Developer Conference, there will be a specific track on workloads. So the stuff you saw earlier from Gunter, as we move towards release of Windows Server 2012, of course, we'll be more focused on really looking at customer-level stuff. But for the developer conference, we'll keep focusing. Some of you gave me some good feedback about, you know, what you really liked about Gunter's talk was the specific I/O patterns and workloads and the 8K blocks, et cetera, et cetera. That stuff is really useful. And Centil and Biao did some of the same stuff here. Plan on seeing them again at SDC. And there, plan on them also being in the PlugFest, hanging out with you, eating the flat food, and having the IV bags full of highly caffeinated beverages, et cetera. So we'll have that there. Again, it's completely up to you how much you want to stress your systems. These are designed to be production-level workloads, but again, we've seen before that you like having SwiftTest and CodeNomicon there to pound on your stuff, and we believe that this is another way to do that in the PlugFest from the context of production workloads that Microsoft offers. We're just speaking for SNEA for a second. SNEA is actively looking at SDC and at the PlugFest to get other workloads involved. So if you know anybody else who has anything there, we're trying to get that in there. Okay, and I'm pretty much done. Just a reminder that after this next session is the last one, right?
Yes.
Okay, so after this last session, anybody who wants to, completely voluntary, will make a trek over to the Microsoft store and see what we can find over there. Yeah, all right, we'll take Centil along so we can burn up the rest of his card.
he'll be available here for the next 10 minutes if you guys want to catch it.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Thank you.